We welcome into the program our friend, author Colin Fleming, who I'm guessing, had he been at the TD Garden last night, would have been one of those Bruins fans standing up and cheering loudly, as they should have been, for Bruce Cassidy.
Yeah, I like Bruce Cassidy. I like coaches who get things done. Like, if you were running a youth hockey team, Kimball, I could see you lining those kids up at the end. You're going to sprint till you heave. And I just, I like that. But I was glad to see that he got a nice ovation. I thought he deserved that. He did nothing wrong. And it's working out really well for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of coaching, and we'll talk more about it, I'm sure, down the road, but a very interesting blog post earlier this afternoon on Bill Belichick, who you suggest is not what he used to be by any stretch.
No, go read it, all you listeners out there that we have, and I give enough away for free to you people. So go to the blog and sign up. You won't, but read the post. Excellent. They've been excellent lately, I feel like. But I pretty much nailed what is wrong with Belichick, where it went wrong, what he is lacking that he used to have. There's a really funny bit about my own motivation, in part as a writer, and it will get you going and bring out your inner Zulu.
There you go. It's simple as that. Go to ColinFlemingLit.com, follow and subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Of course, that's what right-thinking people do out there. But let's talk about some holiday entertainment offerings. And we've expressed our mutual love for yours truly, Johnny Dollar. And this is one of my favorite episodes just because it's so different than most of them, although there's always humor there, but a little something extra in the missing mouse matter.
A lot of humor in it, a lot of a cuteness factor, but not that cuteness ick factor.
No.
It doesn't go too far. And the way that you're able to do that is you have to imbue the work with some wit. And we're getting that from Johnny Dollar. And Bob Bailey, this is one of those episodes where I could just listen to his voice. He has one of those voices that's perfect for his medium. Ella Fitzgerald had a voice, and its natural intonation was, before we get into chops or anything like that, it was perfect for jazz. And Bob Bailey was that way, I feel like, for this radio program in particular. He did other things. But this is really the one that brings out his talents. And we have dear friend Howard McNair, who was, a lot of people were doing double and triple and quadruple and all of that kind of duty on these radio programs. I wonder what it looked like if you were just boomeranging around from place to place. But Howard McNair, who's Doc on Gunsmoke, he was on Johnny Dollar frequently. And we have this mouse named Gulliver who goes missing. Now, I know me and the cat people out there have almost come to blows a few times, but I it's the holidays. I want to be giving. There is a cat in this, and it looks like the cat has done something really not great with this missing mouse who supposedly is able to sing. And the first time I heard this, I was thinking, like, well, this is going to work out well for me at least. It's not a win-win, but at least the cat is going to get its comeuppance. But no, it's fine. And Johnny Dollar is dubious that this mouse that he's searching for, kind of a gig that's beneath him, but it's a lot of money, can sing. And we are going to find out at the big holiday concert at the end.
And I love, there are so many little gems in there when the young man who was involved in the disappearance of Gulliver, when they confront him and they ask, I think it's Johnny Dollar who asks, well, why didn't the mouse sing for him? Well, you never asked him to, did he?
Right. And he says it like in this matter-of-fact way, like, believe this idiot asking me this basic question. Like, you know the teacher, maybe you were this guy, who stands up in front of the students and he's like, there are no stupid questions. But at the same time, he's thinking, yeah, there are.
Yeah.
And, coming from you over here.
And I know exactly who will ask them, yes.
So, what can you say? It's like the perfect riposte. Dollar's like, oh, yeah, my bad. Good point. Thanks.
But I love what's so fun about this episode is Johnny Dollar almost winking at the audience through your radio dial.
There's a degree of, with Laurel and Hardy or David Brent on The Office, you'd always get that sort of turn to the camera. It could be more overt at some times than others, where it was a get a load of this type of thing. And that's an effective way, if you don't take it too far and overdo it, to create a bond with the audience. That it puts you in the picture. You're right there going along with this because you're probably thinking the same thing. And when someone makes, here's the cool bit. When someone makes a gesture like that to us, whether it's verbal or it's their eyes or the sound of their voice just coming through the radio, it's like we're reciprocating that gesture too. Because one person doesn't just make that gesture on their own. It's like a tandem kind of act where I turn to you, it's like, do you believe this? And I give that, the other person gives that look back. So it's just a way to create that connection between character and drama and radio, the medium, and the listener sitting at home.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. From there to a terrific piece that I had only seen once before. I think it was about a year ago I watched it, and then since I knew we'd be talking for it, I gave another viewing to Rod Serling's Carol for Another Christmas, an interesting piece that was done in partnership with the United Nations back in 1964.
And it didn't go over well back in 1964. So to go back to then, we have dear friend Rudolph in that month of December, and we have this. We have the premiere of Rudolph and the first airing of this made-for-TV movie, which was star-studded. They got a lot of people to be part of this. Rod Serling wrote it, and it is something that was slated by critics. And I think when we watch it now, it's a variation on A Christmas Carol, but modern to 1964. And it is quite didactic. It's very talky.
Yes.
One of the criticisms was that it was more of a tract than a bit of drama. And I think that's apt, but it still, it has its moments. It has its details to tell. It has certain aspects that portend to our world right now. And scenes go on too long, and you don't really connect with the Mr. Grudge character, who's the Scrooge. By the way, everyone, Scrooge, 1951, buy my book, because you will connect with Alistair Sim. And that's one of the ways that 1951 film is so successful, because even when Scrooge is pre-changed, we feel for him. We identify with him. We've maybe had holidays where we're alone going around and thinking we're like the biggest loser on earth, which is kind of what Scrooge thinks in that film for all of his bluster. But we don't really get that with the main character of this film. But we do have a sequence at the end with Peter Sellers. And there is it's a community of the Mies, and it's very internet. It's very Twitter and narcissistic. And Peter Sellers is like the leader of the Mies. He's the imperial Mie. And it's after the apocalypse, and some people are left. It's kind of like a mixed metaphor, but still, some are kicking around. And he says that, okay, well, it's the contest to be like the best me, and eventually we'll all kill each other, and that'll be cool. We'll have the ultimate being. And so there's like this African-American guy is like, no, I don't want that. He's also the butler, essentially, for Mr. Grudge at his house. And he's in this other world of the Christmas future. And he says, I'm not going to do that. And he sort of runs away, but within this room, and he goes up the ladder, and he's up there and in this almost like a mizzenmast type of thing. And everyone's chanting for him to jump. And that's a really strange thing. And then this kid, there's this woman next to him knitting, and she has a box on her lap. It's for a gun. It's just like Daddy is sort of the marketing tagline. The little kid takes out the gun and shoots this guy in the chest up there in his perch. So thinking, wow, this isn't festal, but it sort of really hits home with right now.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I like Sterling Hayden in almost everything he's in, but something about his role just doesn't work. But I love the different ghosts. I thought Steve Lawrence doing his best to channel Frank Sinatra, I felt like, as the ghost of Christmas Past. Yeah, it was a wordy, talky scene, but I love that scene.
The ghosts are probably the best part of this. And if you watch it closely, you'll notice that people are doing interesting things while everyone is talking. Maybe they're giving a certain look off to the side or doing something the way they're fidgeting with their hands. It's almost like, will the real Martian please stand up? If you watch that closely, everyone's doing something weird in it or something when our gaze is fixated on the person who's talking. So it's one of those ones that's really great for rewatchability. So I feel like the actors were doing some of that because it was very screedy. I don't know why Rod Serling wrote it that way. You know, from the turns of phrases and the kinds of description, it's so clearly his voice. They could have pared this back and made it more dramatic. The Sterling Hayden character, there's really nothing about him that you like. Even after, he's just like, I'm like 1% less of a dick. It's not that much.
Now, and you see elements of some of the things that Sterling had done in some Twilight Zone episodes. So, yeah, I understand, but I think the critics were a bit too harsh, I'm guessing, compared to what else was out there for dramas in 1964. It had to be pretty good alongside most of those.
Yeah, but I don't know if picture yourself in that environment. You're at home and the family's sitting down and you have certain expectations. It's not that expectations need to be met, nor that they should be, but I feel like it asks a lot of an audience without really giving the audience that much. Rod Serling, he's an interesting character because a number of the best Twilight Zone episodes, they were either highly personal for him or they were written by someone else. I think for him to do his best work as a writer, it had to come from some aspect of his own life. And this was more political commentary. And he was a guy who, with the Twilight Zone, he really peaked with the Twilight Zone. He was like the baseball players writing about Andrew Jones, whose last best year he was still in his 20s. Because Rod Serling, he goes on for a while, and he has a short life, of course. But when he does Night Gallery, it's not, do you know what I mean? It's inconsistent. This is how he's going to be for the rest of his creating life.
Right, right.
So it foreshadows a future insofar as that goes, but it's definitely worth the one watch to see that things that we think are new now were intimated at back then during the time of Beatlemania by a Christmas special from Rod Serling.
Kids, did you enjoy the show? Do you understand now why the United Nations is so important to all of us? Yeah.
Yeah, that's something. Like if you listen to some Bob Dylan songs from like 63 and 64, the performances and the songwriting and the quality of the singing is going to carry certain things. But to most people, they're not going to get now the references on another side of Bob Dylan. It's to his credit that that's not a limitation. And I wonder now, like the United Nations, 1964, I mean, obviously people don't know the difference between then and then. So that's the type of thing it's okay to do something that's topical, but you have to have it really mostly be, this is the key to everything that lasts. It really has to be about the human quotient. And this was more about like the newspaper quotient. And that's not going to be something that's able to last as well.
Right, right. Absolutely. You brought back some memories for me when you sent along. It was very memorable. It took me right back to being 7, 8 years old. CBS Christmas Message from 1966, a brilliant little piece of animation from a guy, I guess his name is R.O. Bleckman.
Yes, Robert to his friends. And that's cool that you remember that from back in the day, and it's only a minute long, but it just speaks, doesn't it, to what a classier world it was at the time. I feel bad putting this in people's heads because they're going to notice it now. But when you're watching TV tonight, Note how many commercials currently feature quote-unquote average people warbling off-key. This Burger King one, there are like 10 of them right now. It's the vogue in commercials to have just some person, I guess it's supposed to be like, this could be you, singing to yourself in the shower about Burger King. There's just so much of that now. And it's a copycat kind of thing. But this animation is elegant. Maybe people have no clue what we're talking about. But what it is this guy, little cartoon dude, he goes out into the woods and minimalistic illustration, cartoon drawing come to life. And he's first we see some birds in a tree, and they're like, it's a good time to be a bird. It's Christmas. We know it is. And this guy comes out to cut down the Christmas tree. But instead of doing that, he decides to play it as a violin and has a touching rendition on his saw/violin of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, and bird, guy, music, us, we're all amalgamated into just Christmas oneness. And it's classy. It's beautiful. It's simple. It's touching.
Yeah, and one of the things that stood out to me in watching it with old man eyes after seeing it as a kid is how peaceful and quiet it is, and you don't think about the time as it's passing, and it seems like everything today, every commercial, every promotional announcement yells at us. And this was something that was very subdued and yet powerful.
Oh, it's transfixing. And I would think that if one played this for a kid, a kid would be transfixed by it. I was thinking about this today. Kids do things right. They experience the world the right way. It's the adults who don't do it the right way. But when you're a kid, you don't screw up being a kid. Adults screw up being adults. And I think the adults who are most successful as adults realize this on some subconscious level and fix it so they don't screw things up in the way that kids are also consistent in being who they should be. It's not like a kid is ever, it's a kid. They're doing what they're supposed to do. And that's more of a, I don't mean like, oh, I lied and stole a cookie and didn't tell mom and that kind of thing. But even that's sort of true to being a kid. And they reach their standards and we don't. And I think this is just a type of simple thing, 62 seconds long, you can sit down with on your own, sit down with your kid. If your kid watches it, they're probably going to want to get the crayons and have a go themselves. I mean, that's great. That's inspiriting.
And I was thinking about this, too, with my own son. One of the things, and I don't know when it will turn for him and when it turns for most kids, but one of the things they are so good at is the thing that so many adults strive to be, and that's the ability to live in the moment. Man, kids have that mastered.
You have to have that mastered to be a successful human. And I've said this to people. I went out the other night to see a film with someone, and we went out for a drink afterwards, and we were talking about writing. And I said, no one ever said this to me, but the most important thing is to be present. When I'm writing something, there is nothing, I'm immediately reabsorbed. Nothing else exists. This is the business of the day. This is what must be handled. I don't mean as work, but the same way that when you're in your life and you get a call that you have to take your great aunt to the hospital because there's no one else, you're in it. You're present. What time should I pick you up? All of that. That's what it's like for me when I write. What time do I pick you up, so to speak? There's nothing else that exists but that environment, that world, those choices. And you can take that around into different parts of your life, the way you hear something, the way you watch a film in the darkness. And it's not even just the phone. It goes beyond that. To be present, it's not to have blinders on, but it's to have it be such that that thing is the thing. There's no after it, there's no next to it, there's no under it. There's just it and you within it. And yeah, kids are awesome at that.
Tell me a little bit about this recording of Jingle Bells by The Who. What period is this from?
This is such madness. No one knows this exists. And it's even like, it's the type of thing that like if you're able ever to find it on YouTube, you have to, it's tricky to ever find again. So there was this really, you might know, there's this really cool show in the mid-60s. after the ascent of the Beatles called Ready, Steady, Go.
Oh, yeah.
And it was in London. It was trendy, and they had presenters, and a lot of it, well, depending upon what year you saw it in, but early on, a lot of lip sync performances, but then this sort of like cute youth figure woman would interview George Harrison about, I don't know, the parties they go to or something like that. So it was like access to these people, the Stones, the Who, they were on there. So the Who have this live performance, this snippet of Jingle Bells, and then this other song that they didn't record anywhere else. They sort of do it as medley. And they'd go on there and do their rhythm and blues act, where rhythm and blues was changing so much into this kind of nascent heavy metal. So they do this heavy metal version of Jingle Bells in the middle of the 1960s. It's really one of the first examples out there that has survived of like, oh, here's actual heavy metal. And it's this throwaway moment. And then we get this other number tagged on to it, which is surf heavy metal with drummer Keith Moon showing like how incredible his technique was. And like, Who fans aren't aware of this? I mean, it's a Christmas recording, sure. And anytime I hear Jingle Bells in any incarnation, I think, wow, what like a drivingly rhythmic number this is. This really gets you going. And it's like it's sort of the Christmas song version of rhythm and blues. So it was perfect for the Who, but it's this nugget from way down in the mine that no one even really knows exists. I've never heard anyone talk about it. I've never seen anyone write about it.
So no,
and I know you and me, people listening, we're the only ones who pretty much know about it.
Rob, that's why I asked you, because I couldn't find much about it online, but it's great. And if you want to have the coolest holiday music mix, find it if you can and put it on there, because it's just great and crazy and awesome.
Oh, some person who's better with technology than I am, although I will get there, you could put this on your mixtape and loop it, because it doesn't last that long. But you could get like, have you ever seen the 12-hour recording of the song from The Blob?
Yes, absolutely.
Like, it creeps and leaps. And like, yeah, it creeps and leaps for like 14 hours on YouTube. And I'm not saying like to go that far, but it's the type of recording, preserved performance, where you're almost doubtful that it is what it is until you like hear Keith Moon. No one has any sound approaching the sound of Keith Moon. There's just nothing like it. You could fake being Hendrix before you could fake being Keith Moon. So there's a total giveaway that it's really them, but it's a really cool recording.
Speaking of Keith Moon, I was listening to satellite radio the other day, and I knew this existed and had forgotten, but I heard Keith Moon singing, doing a version of When I'm 64 from, I think it was the movie All This in World War II. Do you remember that?
Keith Moon, he didn't just sing. He sang a little bit in the Beatles. There are a few, in the Who. There are a number of numbers that he did as Tommy's Holiday Camp and
right.
Bellboy on Quadrophenia, and he loved the Beach Boys. So Barbara Ann, it's him singing that. There's a recording from March 31st, 1966 in France. It's awesome, where he does Barbara Ann on the stage.
Wow.
And he had a solo album. A Keith Moon solo album was really like an excuse to have a huge party on someone else's dime.
Right.
With like horse tranquilizers and everything. I mean, it wasn't even just like, I'll have a Michelob. It's like, I'll have like six horse tranquilizers. And he had this insane love for surf music. Do you know the story of how he joined the band? Like, he's watching the band, whatever, they weren't the Who at the time, and he thinks this drummer sucks. So he just goes up on stage and destroys the kit playing, like, the Beach Boys. And they thought he was insane, but they never heard anyone like that. And it's like, okay, you can be the drummer. And that's really just what it was. But he was, I mean, Ringo Starr, he loved country and Western music. He wanted to emigrate to the States and like hang out with Buck Owens and Hank Williams types and all that. So you never know what's in that closet, Kimball.
No. And finally, we wrap up our discussion for this week with another memory from my misspent youth. Boy, I'd forgotten about this, too. Patricia M. Scarry's scratch-and-sniff holiday book, The Sweet Smell of Christmas.
Oh, I love it so much. And last week I'd mentioned to my sister that Rudolph was on, and I think I told you that, and we were talking about Christmas books, and I told her there was this one I used to love. I was addicted to it. I wore it out. And she sent me a photo. She's like, is this it? I'm like, oh, yeah. And I was thinking about how it's this little bear. He loves Christmas so much. And there are these, I think it's eight scratch and sniff decals in the book. There's a candy cane. There's a mug of cocoa. I'm loving it right now, just mentioning. There's the forest, which, of course, was my favorite.
Yes. Oh, the forest was the best. Yes.
Oh, I mean, it was good. But, like, I would have been generous. I would have been like, all right, Forrest, this doesn't, they cut some corners on this smell. But the concept of the conifers, it's like, oh, like, I'm a man of the sea, but I'm a frequenter of the woods.
Mm.
There's a lot going on. So I just was thinking about how something can transport us to a place. And people might conflate that with nostalgia. And I don't. I'm going to be writing an op-ed about how to navigate a lonely Christmas. And one of the techniques or tips that I have is that think of something that you used to love, not because you want to go back in time, but it's still in you. Find it in you right now in the present tense, because we can take what we find in the present tense that way, and we can use it to contribute to our future, the future that we want to have. So I feel like a lot of times people just want to go back to how things used to be. And I want to go back to a feeling that's never really left me in order to tap back into its utility again. And so that's what that book represents to me. But I love the hell out of that thing. I would read it when I was a kid. And before I could read, my parents would read it to me. I could memorize it just by hearing the words. And I remember reading it, and my dad would be outside, like with a chainsaw, cutting down trees for some reason that was always unclear to the rest of us. Just looking forward to finishing and then putting on my jacket and gloves and all that and going out and hanging with him. And I just love that book so much. And if you're looking for something for your kids or your grandkids or whatever it is, or for yourself, this is a great little book. It's the children's book for all ages, and I really recommend it.
And when you get that, make sure you also get a copy of Colin's book, Scrooge, as well. Colin Fleming, every Tuesday on Downtown. Thank you, Colin. We'll talk with you again next week.
Okay, sounds good.